Welcome back to Classic Guitar and Center, everybody. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, it's Richard Boukas. That's B-O-U-K-A-S. Richard Boukas is on faculty at the New School for Jazz, and that's New School University's Jazz Department. Of course, if you know, you know or you don't know, I'm a graduate, technically, of the New School. Manus is part of that. And Richard is a jazz guitarist and experimental composer. So if you're interested in his music, please go there. And also, he's got a CD release concert he wants me to tell you about. That's taking place on October 28th. On October 28th, make sure that you go to Richard Boukas. That's B-O-U-K-A-S.com. Boukas.com. www.boukas.com for more details. Also, the show is sponsored today by GetBarkBox.com/insider. That's GetBarkBox.com/insider. You can go there and you can get a box filled with treats, gadgets, and toys, like little plush dog toys for your dog. You're going to get one every month. You sign up for 6 months or 12 months, you get 1 month free on me. By the sweat of my brow, I give you this gift. 1 month free. One box of bark toys at getbarkbox.com/insider. Make sure that that's where you go. That way I get a kickback and you get to help out your pooch. I don't like the word pooch. I don't. I miss my dog. My dog died in 2004. It was sad. That was the last time I sobbed like a baby. I mean, and I'm talking about sobbed for an extended period of time. Every once in a while these days, I get choked up. I don't know what it is. I think I'm more in touch with my emotions. I'm trying to be anyway. This job, you know, doesn't give me a lot of time to think. I've been working 12-hour days, guys. You know, really, really, really hammering it out. A lot of teaching. A lot of teaching. And, I got to be in touch with myself emotionally. So if I feel the need to sort of like cry, or if I feel myself getting upset about something, I have to get down to the bottom of it. You know what I mean? Really got to be on top of this, because I think that, I'm going to start hurting people or concerning people at the very least, by the sort of frantic nature of a person that has never really worked a full day before. Suddenly, you know, working like a, I don't know what it is. It feels like a dog. I mean, there was a moment on Friday where it was so chaotic and so out of control. I lost my voice. I got sick last week. I had no voice. I think there's still some residual stuff going on. I'm sure you can hear. And then the actual teacher wasn't there. So I had to teach. I had to teach, like, you know, you would call them lectures or whatever. But really all it was me just, you know, literally keeping children from running out of the door or throwing things at each other while I tried to pepper in little bits about music. But they did well, actually. They took their first test on Friday of the year. And overwhelmingly, it's pretty surprising. Even the ones that seemed like they weren't paying attention at all are picking up stuff. And there was a rhythm test, and it involved eighth notes and rests, and they did rather well. So they are listening. Through all the noise and all the chatter, they're still able to focus, which I find incredibly impressive. You know, what a skill. I mean, there are literally people screaming at the top of their lungs. There are people hitting each other. There are fights breaking out. And there are still kids that are sitting there and have enough focus to learn how to count a rhythm. And they want to give themselves that gift. It's unbelievable. And it's a New York thing. I don't know if that's a state law or whatever, but in New York, they are graded. All the children go through music class. They got to do it. So it's not an elective. And that way they're exposed to music. I don't know. I've always had sort of a cynical attitude about music education. I've always said, well, you know, the problem is there's no jobs. And once you create jobs for them, then the education will become more important to the parents, the students, and the legislative powers that be. And you know, that'll work its way down there. It's a trickle-down economy. But, you know, I still kind of feel that way. I feel like if there's more jobs available other than education, which, you know, as a, look at me, that's what happened. Then people will want to learn this. But it's really good. I really try to, you know, whatever, get excited about it. But it just came down to, you know, at one point it just came down to me doing an interpretive dance to That's What Friends Are For at the end of a class when the teacher was out. The teacher got sick. I had to cover for her. And it was some classes were okay. Some classes were a total mess. And at the end of the day, it was a rainy day too. So the kids were just a total disaster. They didn't get to go to PE. They didn't get to go to recess. They didn't get to go like just run in circles. And that is me just being a little sick still. Engrossing you guys out. What's that? Oh, okay. That's good. That's my buddy Matt. Yeah, you've got it. He's sitting there saying thank you. I got to turn this off though. So we're going to turn off the Wi-Fi. And then but that's Matt. You know, I was at a music festival all weekend, but I was at a rap. I guess it was more or less, it seemed like a hip hop music festival. I was working the burrito stand for my friend that has a restaurant here. And I almost saw Kanye, of whom apparently my mother is just, she's gone to war with this guy. When she found out I was going to see Kanye West, it was like a storm of defamatory texts about Kanye West. I was very surprised. She has some very strong feelings about this man. And a lot of it is defendable. Anyway, but the point is, I didn't get to see Kanye. I opted to cover for my friend. Instead, it was me and my girlfriend, and we both, instead of going and seeing and having the Kanye West experience, we worked the burrito stand at the festival so that everybody else could go and see him. And that's what we did. And as a result, we are immortalized in the eyes of our beloved friends, Matt and Drea, who run Taqueria Diana here in New York. They have three locations in Manhattan. One is in the East Village on 8th and 2nd. And one is on Hell's Kitchen on 39th and 8th. And then one's in Chelsea somewhere. It's great, great, great Mexican food. We've lived on burritos. I don't want to eat another burrito for several months, but I say that now. Give me 2 days. Amazing food. So we got free burritos and free tickets to this thing. We're wandering around. The problem is the music, you know, I like pop music a lot, but I like the pop music that I like. So, you know, I go to these festivals. I've been to Lollapalooza and stuff like that. I go to these things. I don't know any of the bands. Are we getting more texts now, or that's from 1 minute ago? All right. You know what? Everybody's done. Done with everybody. I didn't know who to see, and I didn't like any of the bands. The 1975. I don't know. It seems like a lot of these bands. You know, I like new music. I like indie rock a lot. But like I said, I like who I like. But it seems like a lot of these popular people are just sort of riffing on old ideas. There was this band, the 1975. It was basically just an NXS cover band. They changed the lyrics around. I mean, it's to the point where he even had the same fucking hair. It's... started out strong and it just ended up, you know, a lot of these people just sound like boy bands, really. The saxophone, I noticed, is making a comeback. The show is also sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's SAVAGE Classical.com. Go there. Richard Sage will hook you up with the guitar of your dreams. The summer sale's over, but the savings don't stop. Richard Sage, that's SavageClassical.com in Bayshore, New York. Go there. Tell him Big Diaper Brett sent you. But yeah, so I've been doing that, and I took the day. I did some composition, some hard composition. I will eventually get around to it, but I'm working up solos. The quartet is due for a concert. We might partner. I'll just go ahead and say it. Dan Emery from the New York City Guitar School just offered us his hall in the Upper East Side. They have a new Upper East Side location for those of you that live up there and have wanted to study guitar in a place that's close to your house. And it's on 91st Street. And I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to give them a read for free. That's the New York City Guitar School. If you've ever wanted to learn rock or classical or anything, they got everybody there. They got the guys from 350 Duo. One of them teaches there. It's a great school. It wasn't a good fit for me, but for me to teach at, just because of time restrictions and stuff like that, especially now that I'm doing this. I mean, I don't have time for anything. I'm going up to the Bronx. I'm going to the Upper West Side. I mean, it's an outstanding school. It's a great place to learn any different styles. So that's a New York classical, not the New York classical, New York City guitar school. All right. And I'm going to read for them forever. For a long time, because they give me the space. And the space in New York City is incredibly valuable. It is the one thing standing between me and having concerts in New York City is space. People like La Poisson Rouge was interested in the quartet for sure, but they were like, we need to come see you. And that's what it comes down to, is that these people need to come see you at another venue and see if people like you. They want to see your act. You know, they want to see it live if you're a New Yorker. And so that's what we have to do. We have to start creating more performance opportunities. The quartet's on board. They're being very sweet about it. It's just a time issue, man. But I'm starting to realize, you know, when you're a teacher, you do these little things pop up. Like, I've got the next 2 days off. I didn't expect that. If I would have known that, I wouldn't have been so stressed. But you do, as a teacher, you get a lot of days off. They're not paid. But you get a lot of days off. A little bit of whiskey right now for my nighttime read. These reads are usually done in the morning, but I do them when I can. But the practicing, the production aspect of the music is something that I still need to work out. But I don't know, something about me is not completely let down yet. If I went several weeks without any real movement, without a real composition happening or recording or some sort of concert booked or whatever, then, you know, and that's kind of what's happened. That's when I get a little worried. But today was a good day. Today, some stuff got done. Anyway, the show's also sponsored by, let me just get my thing. Let me go back to not creatives. I'm sorry about this. Okay, now I messed up everything. You know, the show's sponsored by, there it is. That's right, Casper, where are you? Where's your creatives? I'm not connected to the internet. I did that because people were starting to text. Just give me a minute here, guys. Be cool. You guys are cool. What am I talking about? We're good? There we go. So messed up the way they... Yeah, go to CasperTrial.com/insider. That's CasperTrial.com/insider. Let's sell some more mattresses. CasperTrial.com/insider. You need to sleep so that you can practice, so you can make money, so that you can practice. All right, you don't want to end up like me. You don't want to end up like me. You don't want to end up in a situation where, you know, you're unable to make music again. So if you're young and you still got the support of your parents and stuff like that, go out there and make sure that you get the sleep that you need. And if your mattress is giving you trouble, you got to take care of that first. The first thing you should do before you buy a new guitar, before you sit down and practice, is make sure that you have enough sleep. And in order to do that, you might want to go to CasperTrial.com/insider. Just check it out. I get a huge kickback on it. It's a big deal. These are memory foam mattresses that are made by the smartest and most intelligent people in the known universe. All right, these people could have been making anything. They could have been making bombs. They could have been making microwaves. They could have been making dog toys for getbarkbox.com/insider. But instead, they're making mattresses. You know, they're getting you guys to sleep so you can do your job better. And that's important. And so that your eyes can look a little better. This job is going to kill me. This job, with the bartending, I think I let a lot of people down. I think people were like, you know, we kind of thought that you would be a good bartender, and it turns out you quit and you got fired, stuff like, yeah. And so I'm trying to push this one further. You know, I don't want to be the guy that just doesn't do well in a job. I know that the bartending thing was not for me. It has never been for me. Any sort of service or retail job, it's just, I don't know what it is. Something about it doesn't sit right. This has a humanitarian element to it. You know, teaching kids in neighborhoods that don't have access generally to music, that or to classical music, that's important work. But dude, it is literally like, there are points where I'm literally wrestling without hands with these kids, just trying to get them from leaving the classroom. I don't know if that's sustainable, you know? I mean, it's pretty stressful. Just the idea of having to go back in 2 days is sort of rough. But at the same time, that's the way I function. I shy away from these kinds of commitments, and I think it's hurt my life a little bit. Everybody's job is stressful, right? But this seems like this is sort of a classically stressful job. Service industry and inner city school education are sort of classically very known to be very challenging physical jobs. I'll see how long I can do it. I'm gonna do it. Jeez, I'm gonna do it. I just need to have a concert. If I can do it and keep on playing, then I'm good. If I can't play, I don't know, man. I have to be able to play. You know, you see the Nina Simone documentary. She says that. She goes like, "Well, I had to be able to play, so." I needed money and I had to be able to play. So she played it like a burlesque play. So she had to be able to play. She said that she was like, "Well, yeah, I had to play." As if it was a matter of fact, you know, and that's what we forget is that this need to play, it's a matter of fact that most people don't have. They don't have that need. They have other needs. A lot of people need to not have a roommate when they're 39. A lot of people need to be able to eat steak every week. Or go to every baseball game or go to every concert. That's a need that people have. That's not a need that I have. Every Broadway show. People have a need to travel. I have one sort of extracurricular need, if you will, and that is to create and perform music. And if I'm not performing, I really feel, I feel it. It feels bad. And it's starting to feel bad. So I gotta fix that. You know what I mean? All right, let's get on with Richard Bukas. Again, that's caspertrial.com/insider. Getbarkbox.com/insider. And also, as always, savageclassical.com. All right, visit him, Richard Sage. The big guy will help you out. Make sure you visit Richard Bukas at his October 28th CD release concert, bukas.com, for more. Here's Richard Bukas.
Well, that's what we're going to do.
The ensembles that I teach in Brazilian music, there are just really my huge projects there. But anyway, the live CD has 10 original compositions, and the instrumentation is Lucas Pino on woodwinds, myself on guitar and vocals, Gustavo Amaranci on bass, and Mauricio Sottarelli on drums. And these guys are just lights out. I mean, like, they are the ideal band. And for me in this project, rather than those of people who are familiar with my work being like very guitar centric, this is not as guitar centric because it's really about the group and the compositions.
Are these other teachers?
At
New School?
No, they're not. Actually, Lucas is a former student. He graduated in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
He's a young cat, and he's an incredible saxophonist.
This is Lucas from the...
Lucas Pino, yeah. And the other two guys are like the top call bass player and drummer,
yeah.
Like Brazilian drummer and bass player, Gustavo and Mauricio. And so...
And this is their group. You guys all share this group?
No, it's my group.
It's your group.
It's my group, my music. I get the gigs. And
you have to...
And I got to hustle.
You got to hustle. Give them some money.
Yep, and these guys, they take care of the music so well that if we don't have a concert in 3 months, I just give them the set list, or if I have like two or three new tunes, I just send them PDFs of the charts, and then we run it down at the sound check and play it at the concert.
Right, exactly.
They're just
I'm going to back you off just a little bit. You're doing good. It's just the actual, whatever the voice combination is.
Sure.
Go ahead.
So anyway, so this CD is really the first CD of this group, and I really want everybody to check it out because I think the music and the treatment of the music and the role of the guitar, principally as accompanist, can be very interesting to cats that are looking for, like, you know.
That's one of the main things we're talking about here, and that's, you know, one of the concerns people like you, not you specifically, generally have with coming on the show is that it's a classical guitar show.
Right.
The thing is that, you know, I personally, I have a quartet. I am in the same situation. It's a classical quartet.
Right.
But it's a quartet.
Right.
It's got clarinet, violin. The thing is about it is that these are the kinds of projects that I would like to see more classical guitars going in.
Yeah.
Because it just seems like we're limited to just, you know, we get this education and we get out there and then we're really only supposed to what? Just be a soloist?
That's right.
And there's not enough room for that.
And
we got to be creative. We got to do more stuff like this.
Well, not only for survival, you know, in 2016.
No, but for artistic.
But the other thing.
Survival of the art form.
The other thing really, and that's the reason why at the New York Guitar Seminar early this month, my workshop was basically geared towards accompanimental vocabulary six different genres, and because I wanted these guys to understand that time is not a magazine, you know what I mean? Like, you got to have, like, to play Brazilian music with swing and precision and with definition, your time has to be killing, but not necessarily metronomic, but, you know, you're not going to get great time just practicing your solo repertoire with a metronome. You got to play with people. It's fluid. It's human.
You got to play with people.
Yeah, you got to play. You got to play with people and find where the beat is. And so, so this workshop was really satisfying. And by the way, I just want to let everybody know, if you go to bukas.com/New York Guitar Seminar with dashes between those words, New York Guitar Seminar, the entire video of the workshop, which is about an hour and a half, will be up on that page very soon. Probably by the time you launch the podcast.
Yeah, this will be like a month or something.
Yep.
But the thing is, so that's what your thing is. So you and Michael Newman, do you guys have a relationship? He runs the
festival. Well, Michael and I have known about each other's work. Because
that's unique. This festival was kind of unique in the sense that you had Clarice Assad, who is not even a guitarist.
Right.
She played with her dad, which was, you know, I've already said on the show before, it was just an amazing, I don't know if I actually said that, but I'm by the time this comes out, I will have said it, an amazing performance. But the whole thing is that particular thing, I think it was something about Michael Newman and Laura Altman's understanding that the festival was taking place downtown. We're in your house now.
Right.
Manus is
this
in
is
your
the first,
house.
The first
it's
year.
It's in the New
That's
School
right.
Jazz
That's
building
right.
now.
Well, I mean, we are now the College of Performing Arts. So
I think he wanted to bring you in and have this new sort of idea, this idea of fusion.
Well, he's had a building interest in Latin guitar music for a long time, and I really give him a lot of credit for bringing attention to that, not only at the New York Guitar Seminar, but to his students. And Michael's the kind of guy where, you know, once he puts his mind to something, we're kind of alike, that once we put our mind to something and we have the vision and it's clear, then we're like pit bulls until we get it done. And so actually the way Michael and I got closer this past academic year was he invited me and my Brazilian Choro ensemble to perform at the first Latin guitar.
Oh, you got a Brazilian Choro ensemble.
Latin guitar night. So my Brazilian Choro ensemble at New School, we performed about five pieces, and then with João Luiz, great João Luiz, I performed one of my guitar quartets, and then I played some solo stuff. And so out of that, he started to really get some real specifics as to what I was doing, because we had known about each other's work for a long time.
Yeah. 100%.
So he invited me, you know, to be a part of the guitar seminar, and needless to say, I was flattered and really, really excited. And I really wanted the workshop to be something that people could really go home with. And so the handouts are on the site, and you can just practice.
And you said that. You said that. You know, the workshop, which I unfortunately wasn't able to go to. The workshop. What did you? You have already touched on the fact that you were focused a lot on
accompaniment. Well, I was focused on accompanimental styles in a duo context. Duo context. In other words, what do you do when you are a guitarist accompanying either a solo woodwind instrument or, let's say, another guitarist? You know, what is your role? What content? What do you have to flesh out in order for things to sound complete? Right. And that's real different than what you need to do in a rhythm section when you got a bass player and a drummer. So, obviously, if you listen to my quartet CD, you'll see how the guitar functions in that Brazilian jazz context. But in this context, duo, you have to be the rhythm section. You are the bass player, the drummer, and the piano player.
In the quartetto, it's sort of you seem to function more or less like a piano. Small rhythm section,
or like a piano,
a rhythm section of a big band.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, and
you know, just comping, vamping chords, I guess you would call it. I don't know. I didn't go to jazz school, but isn't that what it's called?
I'm comping. Yeah, right. I'm basically comping. Sometimes
filling in the holes.
Sometimes the comping is scripted and notated, like down to the last note voicing, and then sometimes it's a little looser. But anyway, so the workshop at New York Guitar Seminar was really a lot of fun to do, because I think it gave people some ownership over things that technically weren't that difficult. I got into, you know, the idea of right hand independence between the thumb and the other fingers, and so I covered samba canção, choro, bossa nova, baião, and valsa. So I covered those six genres. And
hey, who's that guy? Who's that guy with the weird instrument that does the bass and the guitar at the same time?
Stanley Jordan?
Not Stanley Jordan, the guitarist. I'm thinking of I can't remember. It's a trio.
Chapman Stick?
Charlie Hunter Trio.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Where he does a thumb and he does a bass, and he's also got the rest of his hands doing the guitar.
Yeah, so the thing is, for accompaniment, I mean, you need bass line function, and then you need the harmonic content.
And you don't have a bassist. Do you have a bassist?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Gustavo Amaranci.
Oh, yeah, okay. I just didn't see his big bass.
So he's the rock.
He's got electric bass.
Plays electric five string.
Yeah. Oh, electric five string.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you choose that five string, or did he? Were you just?
Oh
like,
no,
hey,
it, no, he.
It's you his, just love it, him.
I love the five string. I mean, if people want to use a six string with a high C string, that's just cool too. The more strings, the better. But anyway, so it was exciting to do the workshop.
Well, the workshop also, like you're saying, so the difference between, you know, being in various ensembles, whether you're going to accompany a clarinet or whether you're going to accompany
cello,
a guitar.
I have a duo with a cellist.
Now, what would you say? Let's talk about a cellist. What do you think? I mean, that's sort of an interesting role. I mean, I've always had a little bit of an issue with the timbre of guitar and cello.
Really?
I have had a little bit.
I think they're like married, man.
I think they're almost married, but I think, I don't know. You think so? Cause,
okay, so
I think it's too rich. I think it's too much.
All right, I have an explanation for that, which actually relates back to Brazilian choro. But first of all, I do have a duo since April with Wendy Law.
Uh-huh.
If you go to Law-Bucas Duo, you can hear this amazing cellist.
So she's a cello.
She's a cellist.
She's
an amazing virtuoso, and basically I adapted a lot.
I take back everything I said.
I adapted a lot of my existing Brazilian jazz music for this duo, as well as wrote for cello and guitar. And so we gave our first concert in April, and it's great. The thing that's great about it is that, you know, when the cello takes bass function, then everything gets inverted. And so I can become more of a thematic instrument. And it's extremely fluid if you arrange things properly.
Because what I've seen arranged is the guitar is accompanying what would be a violin or a voice, and it's a cello. Mm-hmm. Say you're doing Bacchiana's Bucaneras.
No, I've got her playing bass lines.
You got
as well.
Her playing bass lines.
Oh,
with the bow?
Both bow and pits.
Sweet.
But both bow and pits. And
that's
actually,
what I want. That's what I want to do. Don't tell my bassist. Josh is the best. He's awesome. But I now wish that I had written for cello. Because that bass, I can't take it anywhere. Every time we take it somewhere, we got to get two cars.
Yeah, yeah.
So I should have just got a fucking cello.
So the thing that you're talking about being too rich.
Yeah.
One of the aspects of traditional choro ensembles, guitar specific, is that you've got the six string guitar, which is comping, you know. And then you've got the secchi cordis, the seven string, which is playing these beautiful moving bass lines, mostly in between phrases.
And is that the seven string Is it a bass or is it a guitar?
No, it's a guitar and it has a low C.
But it plays bass lines.
It has a low C string, and its primary function in a shoro ensemble is the bass function. So there's no bass player in shoro. You usually have a cavaquinho, the little four string steel ukulele, and then you have pandeiro, the your solo instrumentalist who's a flutist, clarinetist, or a mandolinist. Yeah. And then you've got the sixth string and then the seventh string. So a lot of times, if those of you folks who know shoro and know Jaco de Bandolines, like classic group Epica de Ouro from the 1960s, there are points where César Faria, the sixth string player, and Gino Cecchicordas, the seventh string player, are playing like these parallel thirds bass lines that are really low, and they sound smoky and funky. And from an arranging point of view, like traditional people say, oh, that's too muddy down there. No, that's the style. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying it's too rich, there are times when Wendy and I will be playing melodies and bass lines together that are in the low register, and getting clarity there and still having the richness not be compromised is one of those things that
one of the beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
It's one of the missions and one of the things. I mean, that's when I say rich, I you're right. I just mean for an entire, 2-hour concert. Mm-hmm. Just that. I have the same issue with solo guitar. I just think listening to the same timbre, you know, and slight variations for that long is a little.
It's tough.
A little rough on a regular audience. I mean, people like us can kind of get into it because we've been to lots of performances. Yeah. But I definitely think that, like what you're saying, you know, having the knowledge that that's an issue, and then if you're composing your own works or arranging your own works as you are, and if you're performing with the same person, you can make certain adjustments and concessions to make sure that doesn't become as big of an issue as it could.
Yeah, well, like for example, I'm always looking at programs from a top down point of view.
Interesting.
You know, so for example, like on the live CD, the Quartetto Moderno CD, when I got the call to perform at New School as part of the convention called Analytic Approaches to World Music, we were like the keynote concert.
Analytic Approaches to World Music.
It's a very small organization that has an annual conference.
Yeah, because world music would generally be considered folk music or traditional. It's not analyzed that much.
Right. So anyway, make a long story short, when I got the call for the gig, I said, okay, here's an opportunity for me to write up to 7 new pieces. And what I literally did was I wrote down the genres and the tempos and the sequence of them before 7 of the 10 pieces were written. Mm. And then I started to say, okay, what do you feel like today? Oh, I feel like a frevo. And so I had been listening to Chopin.
That's amazing.
I had been listening to Chopin for the last couple of weeks, and so I wrote a frevo dedicated to Chopin. And so every tune on this CD,
it's great.
Every tune on the CD is dedicated to either a great Brazilian musician like Ginga or Jovino.
But what a great creative vehicle!
Well, I mean, the idea is that you have to think of the audience and think about like what's their experience going to be. And I mean, if you put like 4 sambas in a row, and then and you know what I'm saying?
I just wrote two. I just wrote two. I just realized the last two pieces. I just sat down. I started practicing it. A solo that I wrote. I wrote a song for voice in the quartet.
Right.
I look out. They're both in G major. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh shit.
Oh, that's okay.
I got 20 minutes of G major.
No,
here.
That's okay. I'm sure your stuff is harmonically really interesting.
What I'm saying is like you're right. Like if you actually just like take a second, take a step back when you are approaching. I think people can take away from this something very important, which is when you are approaching the next year of your life. Maybe map it out a little bit before you just, you know, start getting
old. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, so basically the idea of planning a program as a series of genres which have their own...
Yeah, you have
their own tempos, you know, it creatively gives you a really boost. And then the other thing that I really have to say about the great musicians in the quartet is that I have this amazing sonic and visual, vivid image of them on stage. So when I'm writing, I'm basically like they're literally sitting by my side. And so it facilitates my writing to the point where it's almost like they're telling me what they dig and what they don't dig. Mm-hmm. And so when you know the people you're writing for, and then, you know, when you get to solo guitar, when I was writing the Ginga Suite, which is a seven-movement suite dedicated to the amazing Ginga, it was as if
who's Ginga?
Who's Ginga?
Oh. You gotta help me. I don't know.
Oh my God.
Here to help.
Oh my God. Ginga is probably, next to Hermeto Pascoal, the most important Brazilian composer alive, who happens to be a guitarist. He's self-taught, does not read or write music, but he composes the most
Ginga.
Ginga. G-U-I-N-G-A. He composes the most amazingly profound music, and the people around him that help him produce his concerts and his CDs are like top shelf Brazilian musicians. And Ginga has been such a deep influence on me, not only as a guitarist and guitar composer, but as a musician. He's so intuitive. He'll take forms on the neck and move them up and down until he finds, you know, the right combination of open and fretted strings, and that's kind of like his exploration. That's his thing. Like, the guitar is like a laboratory. And so when I wrote the Ginga Suite in seven movements, it took me about a year and a half to write it. Each movement has got that quality to it, where there are different forms on the neck that are moving. Say, I dig that, therefore it will be in the piece.
Right.
It's really pleasure principle. And
pleasure principle.
Yeah,
100%.
You know, I mean, and one of the other things that I want to say about composing in general that's just so inspiring, and this, of course, includes composing for guitar, is that, you know, one of the beauties about harmony is that when you find just the perfect harmony with the perfect bass note within that harmony to support the melody at different times, it's such a satisfying feeling to know, like, that's it. It can't be anything else. So when you listen to Bach or Brahms or Chopin, it's like they make all the right choices.
It's about they make
all those right harmonic choices and the inversions and what's the voicing and this. So the specificity of that, you know, sometimes is really important to embed in your compositions so that there's no genericization of your comping or the bass line. Now, in the case of my quartet, a lot of times I will deliberately underwrite the parts because I know that all I have to do is write the basic changes for Gustavo, the bassist, and he's going to tear it up. And I don't need to write a drum groove for Mauricio Sottarelli. So a lot of times he'll read off the bass chart. So you know, when you trust your players to have taste and to know the styles and to really, really understand your vision as a composer, then you don't necessarily need to write absolutely every last detail. But if you want to guarantee that other performers on those instruments than them are going to be able to just step in and do it, then you need charts that are super specific. So you can never be too specific, because then when you can't be guaranteed that your performance is going to be at the highest level of quality and specificity, then you have to go back and start fleshing things out. So, for example, Paolo Bellinacci, you know, good friend and just an amazing contributor to the music. When he wrote the Afro Sambas, he wrote out the accompaniment to the Afro Sambas. And if you look at this, it's like Michelangelo. Every note is perfect. It's just a sculpture. And him and Monica Salmazo, you know, this CD of the Afro Sambas is just... If a classical guitar player wants to see how a classically trained Brazilian guitar player approaches accompaniment, in this kind of setting, like that album Afro Sambas is really the thing. That's the thing to check out.
Well, I mean, you're talking about him for you know, for the Afro Sambas. What are the other, you know, what else? Who else? You said
Well, as far as guitar players, I mean,
what are your guitar playing experience? Did you do classical when you were a kid?
No, I didn't.
What'd you do?
I just like
jammed around like me.
Folk rock, finger picking,
and then eventually you're like,
R&B,
and then eventually you hear samba, and you're like, "This
well,
is shit." Are we talking about Stan Getz?
Well, early '70s, I went through my fusion period where I was playing McLaughlin and you know that kind of like insane
Friday night in San Francisco, all that shit, right?
Insane fusion stuff, and then I slowly started getting turned on to jazz, got into bebop in the mid '70s, and then
how'd the bebop thing go for you?
It went well, although most of my compositions up until a certain point were very derivative. In other words, basically they were almost like my reflections on Wayne Shorter and Joe Henderson. Right. As, you know,
and so, you couldn't get out of it.
Well, I knew that that wasn't. I even then knew as a 22 year old
there was something else in you.
Well, I knew that I had to go through that period mm-hmm. of composing and band leading to start to find my own voice, and then once my trio record came out, Embarcadero in 83, that was a huge departure because half of the music was even eighth note. It wasn't swing.
Why'd you call it Embarcadero?
San Francisco? I was sitting underneath the bridge, and I wrote the title tune, Under the Bridge. It's very romantic sounding, but that's right. Exactly what happened. I wrote the tune sitting down.
So you were in your early 20s in San Francisco? Is that
no, this was, I just turned 30, mm-hmm. and I was in San Francisco for a couple of months, and very inspiring place. Maybe not now, it's kind of, you know. But back then it was...
Now it's supposedly, I don't believe this, but supposedly it's more expensive to live on the peninsula than it is
here,
which is insane.
Yeah. But anyway, Embarcadero was a real departure in a lot of ways for me, and that was trio with John Reilly and Mike Formanek, and then it reached the point in the late 80s where my compositions really needed to go back to a larger group. So then I formed Amazona. In 90.
What made you do that? Amazona sounds like we're talking about Brazil now.
Yeah, this was my first real dedicated Brazilian band, and I had a pianist play because I needed that.
What about Embarcadero? Just to go back for that for a second. Well, I didn't hear that, but what's the style of that?
Well, it goes from a couple of bebop type tunes to like even eighth note quasi ECM stuff
What's ECM mean?
You know, like even eighth note, kind of open even eighth note, like spatial kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
More open modal, modal kind of vibe.
Right, you're almost counterpoint.
But there's a couple of sambas on there. There's a huge solo guitar dedication to Chopin, which basically takes about 15 of his themes and melds them into one piece.
Gorgeous.
I've never notated it, but it's called Chopiniana. And all of my older releases are on, like, iTunes and all
that kind
of
stuff. Sure.
But anyway... So I formed Amazona, and the compositions were sprawling. I mean, I'm talking about, like, the scores were 40 pages long, and the parts for, like, me and the bass player, you know, and the piano player were, like, 10 pages long. I had to hire page turners at the recording session. That's how crazy it was. So the compositional imperative made trio not viable for me, unless I was going to be playing, like, the Brazilian songbook, which I still do. I play, like with Trio Brasileiro, with the same bassist and drummer, Gustavo and Mauricio. Mm-hmm. We play, like, gigs, trio gigs, where I'm playing mostly non-original material, where it's just mostly Brazilian songbook, where we're playing and I'm singing in Portuguese, and then some very guitar centric stuff, some Rafael Rabello stuff, you know all kinds of great stuff, Garoto.
And when did you start learning Portuguese?
Seriously,
like in 90?
No, 98, which was the first time I went to Brazil.
So you were like, okay, I'm playing the music, it's time for me to learn the
language. Well, I mean, I was asked by the Brazilian government to be guest professor at the Campos do Jordão festival, which is one of the most important music festivals
in
Brazil.
And you were a professor at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in new school?
I mean, I was teaching in university since 85. I was teaching at William Patterson College, then Manus College, and then New School. So I've been.
When you taught at Manus, Manus had its
own little jazz program, and then we merged with the New School jazz program, and that's, thank God, what gave me my job down at New School in '95. We merged with Manus. Manus and New School merged, and so I'm kind of a grandfathered faculty member. So very, very, very grateful for. That continued.
And that was 95 when they merged?
Yeah, they merged in 95.
I didn't know it was that later. I thought it would have been. Because is that when the school moved?
No.
Where did you teach? Upper East Side or Upper West Side?
I taught Upper West Side.
Okay.
I taught Upper West Side, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, getting back to the thing. Mm-hmm. So Amazona, if you listen to that project, it's like there are many vocal layers sometimes. I have like six or seven voices going on. I'm playing all the guitars. I'm playing all the percussion. And the arrangements are...
You play percussion, too.
Yeah. I mean, I play percussion and sing with Gary Morgan's Pan Americana Big Band, which is an extraordinary big band. That's actually coming back to the workshop, the New York Guitar Seminar workshop.
Yeah.
What I did for Samba and for Baião is I demonstrated the original percussion instruments first. just to show them where this stuff comes from. Like it's not,
yeah,
it's not like rocket science. It's like, here's what the tambourine does. I mean, here's what the triangle does. And basically, I demonstrated all these percussion instruments and said, okay, now this is your right hand.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was like an epiphany for these guys, saying, wow, man.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you got to study percussion. You got to study rhythm sections. You can't just like to take the one actually very important thing about accompaniment and comping, as you know, you might call in jazz, is that you can't just take like a two-bar pattern you learn in acoustic guitar magazine and then repeat it. It's like comping. There's a term in ethnomusicology. It's a German word called Fortspinnung, which means perpetual development. So the idea is that you're playing in a style, but that there's certain rubric, there's a certain realm of vocabulary that's considered to be like good for that style, and you need to know that range, and you need to have your comping rhythmically be in perpetual development. You know, just like an improvised solo, you're improvising your comping, yet under the umbrella of a genre which you have studied. You know,
okay, that's interesting. That is different than I think what most people would think. I think most people would think that comping is simply a matter of complementing the melody.
Oh, it is.
Or the bass line. Whereas you have to do that.
No, it's all.
And then while you do that, you also have to have your own line.
Well,
and your own identity and your own development.
Well,
happening. Development is an interesting idea.
First of all,
as a non-jazzer,
I mean, if you listen to any great Brazilian music recording, and you listen to great pianists and great guitarists, and you transcribe just the rhythm of what they're doing,
right?
Just transcribe just the rhythm. I mean, it'd be great to get the voicings too, which is of course the next level of profoundness. But if you just transcribe the rhythms and look at them. And say, man, you know, it's like it looks like it's almost the same, but it keeps on morphing. It keeps on changing. And if you're supporting a soloist that's improvising and they're peaking, you can't play the same pattern that you started their solo with.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you're not even thinking in terms of modular patterns anymore.
Right.
Because you've got a drummer and a bass player, and it's like they are uplifting you into this zone where you have to have the awareness of the entire rhythm section and your role in that, and then your dialogue with the soloist. And then because my players, especially Mauricio Zottarelli, the drummer, he is so interactive that I've got my own thing going on with him at the same time. So there's all of these multifaceted levels of musical connectivity and interaction going on at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a jazz mentality, but applied to Brazilian music.
Yeah.
The rhythmic vocabulary is Brazilian, but the idea is that if you even have a support role, there's no autopilot. There's no, like, just kind of going through the motions. Because, man...
Okay. So that's the jazz mentality, that there's no autopilot.
Well, I mean, jazz is an African-American form. So it comes back to the drum. If you listen to the ritual drum music in Ghana, and if you transcribe what those drums are doing, and you look at what each drum and the whole blade, ding, 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 you just transcribe all that stuff, you see that it is morphing. It sounds the same the first time
it's
you listen to it,
but
when you go into it deeper,
right,
you hear the development.
You hear development within each individual component.
That's right.
And
that's
what you're going for.
Yeah, and that's what you're going for
mentality.
Yeah, and now if you're in a rhythm section, that's one thing. If you're comping,
how does that compare to the Brazilian mentality? And I mean, we're not being offensive to Brazilian music at all. You're the biggest fan out there.
No. I mean, I think. Well, first of all, you know, Brazilian music is.
I mean, they're trying to have. They want to have fun.
It's
fun.
First of all, in the most beautiful of ways,
right.
Brazilian music, culture, and language, and aesthetic is cannibalistic by nature. Which means that they will draw upon all kinds of exogenous and endogenous influences and come up with this beautiful patois of something, and then that's your music. See, the reason, you know, Brett, the reason why I think I got into Brazilian and Afro-Cuban music back in the mid-70s is because even while I was getting my early bebop thing together, I knew that I was going in the sand footprints of Wes and Pat Martino and George Benson and Django. I knew that I needed to go through that self-schooling to get to elevate my improvisational level and technical level. But that was all in preparation for me getting involved with Brazilian music more deeply, because the book hadn't been written yet. I think that to find your voice as a jazz soloist is very difficult, because the best music that possibly could have been made was made by 1970.
Right.
And now, that's not to say that there isn't great jazz music by some great young leaders, including Lucas Pino, my saxophonist. He's got an amazing nonet. But but my point is that I didn't feel like there was that much more headroom for me to develop as a player.
And a traditional standard, as an improvisation
person, as a composer. But Brazilian music offered me this incredible window where you know, I could basically let the influences, you know, combine as they wished.
Right.
So that's why I write chamber music. That's Brazilian influence. That's why I write choral music. That's Brazilian influence. That's why I write solo guitar music. That's why I write for, you know, my Quarteto Moderno, you know, Brazilian jazz. Because, you know, the influences of jazz and classical music and Brazilian music, it's all, you know, it's all in play.
That's
I guess that's what I'm saying. The boxes, you know, the marginalization and the way that music media tries to market you in a box is so, like, uncharacteristic of great Brazilian music.
Yeah, yeah.
If you listen to a CD of Ginga, for example, every tune has a different instrumentation. Mm-hmm. It can sound like a symphony, and then he's playing guitar solo. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, the thing about Brazilians is that when they hear a certain orchestration or a certain thing, and when they're producing a CD, they get it. If they want five flutes for two bars, they get the five flute players. You know what I mean? It's like there's no limits to texturally and what people are hearing and what they go for. So for me, I felt that there was much more room to grow as a musician, you know, embracing these traditions. And,
one of the things that you do that's interesting is that you do the sing and play sort of,
mm-hmm.
which is indicative of Brazilian music.
There's a lot,
but you know,
there's a lot of vocal scatting.
There's a lot of vocal scatting, vocal interplay between you and the sax player.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so like as far as like, you know, taking like that element, I mean, where do you fall as a singer?
Well, okay. So in that context, I basically treat the voice as an instrument. I've been scatting since I've been scatting forever, whatever the style of music is. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, like I mentioned to you earlier, when I had my trio,
right?
You know, it started to get to the point where the compositions were getting much more involved.
Yes.
So I had to start scatting the melodies and comping for myself because it was too empty. But from a point of view of diversification of thematic instruments, I treat the voice as a foil to Lucas on the saxophone, and sometimes we'll do stuff in.
What do you mean by foil? What do you mean?
Well, kind of like we're kind of balancing each other out.
Like a fencing foil?
No. I mean, like we're kind of balancing each other out.
Right.
So, for example, if the form of a tune, like just for sake of argument, the form of a tune is A B C A,
right?
And if he plays A and B, it's like I'm going to play C because he needs a rest.
Yeah.
So for example, in Frederic Frevo, the Frevo that I wrote dedicated to Chopin. I play the C section, and it's really difficult, but mm-hmm. I play the C section because he's been blowing the soprano with almost no breath for like a minute and a half. So, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. But as far as voice, I mean, you know, I've always sung. I mean, you know, I've been singing early music, you know, Renaissance music, and I'm a choral.
Were you ever
choral conductor?
Choral conductor. Did you ever do early music? Do you ever sing like you know, We Am the Macho or anything?
Of course,
like that?
Of course, all that stuff.
Yeah,
I was singing that stuff in my 20s. I mean,
I love that stuff.
I was in
an early music choir in Texas, mm-hmm. Requisite or whatever.
Right.
And I was like, I was young. And I was like, I gotta go like do this old fucking music.
Let me tell you.
I went in there and it was the most beautiful, just being in the middle of all those people and like in that music.
To give you a quick thing, when I entered NYU at 17 years old, mm-hmm. 1970, I had huge ears. I couldn't read or write music. I didn't knew no music theory, but I knew something when I heard it. So
why'd they let you in?
No, actually, no. I was on scholarship. I was on full scholarship.
All right, good.
It wasn't because I had the scratch.
Right.
Not then. But the bottom line,
they saw something in
the
you. The kid's got something.
The bottom line was that, you know, the fast track for me getting my musical and notational and theoretical thing together.
By the way, I was in the same exact boat as you.
Okay.
I was not a note reader when I was 10.
I joined two choirs at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And within 6 months, I was able to sight sing anything put in front of me.
No, there you go.
Including Webern and Shostakovich. And
you were able to sight sing Webern and Shostakovich?
Yeah.
Come on now.
Yeah.
You're not. I believe you, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm not kidding you, man.
No, I mean, I've seen your stuff.
In 6 months, I just like.
Why are jazz people so much smarter than us? Can you explain that to me? Why are you guys so smart?
Oh, I'm not going to go there. That's a loaded.
I'm not sight singing any.
That's
favor.
A loaded question. But,
all right, go ahead.
But anyway, so I and then you know in the 1980s to support my record label Jazz Essence, which you know cost me a fortune, I got into jingle singing and producing. So yeah. I was playing.
This is not a Jazz Essence release.
No, it's an independent release.
Right.
My record label is defunct.
You're doing whatchamacallit singing.
I was doing jingle singing.
Jingles.
I sang the first Coors Light jingle.
Let me hear it.
It's the right beer at the right time. It's the silver bullet and it's tasting fine. It's a new way. I mean, that 1988.
Yeah.
1988. So come on into Coors Light. It's the right beer now.
That was you?
That was me.
You singing. That's you.
And I made so much money off that jingle that I was able to release three recordings with it.
It's a 1988. But your biggest competition is McKenzie.
So I've got a closet, and a lot of people can relate to that. I got a closet full of these recordings.
Yeah, me too. You know what I did when I moved out of here? I threw out. It was the hardest thing to throw out. I had them all right here. This was not that long ago.
Right,
I actually
right.
finally threw out. She was like, "I want all your shit out of here," and so I said. Okay, because I had just stuff up in the closets.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just have the thing. She's really great about letting me use the place. Wendy's the best.
Cool.
But I had, you know, my thousands of CDs
from
10 years ago.
I know, man.
And I was just sitting there and I was going like, you know.
What am I
going
to do with
I'm
this?
I'm selling two of them at a concert nowadays. I used to make like a bunch of money selling them. Now I sell two at a concert. I'm looking at them.
You gotta lower the price.
Guess
man.
What I did?
Not only
did I lower the price, but this is what I did. I threw out half of them. I just threw them out. I was like, these are fucking worthless.
You have to get creative. Like, so, for example, at some of the concerts that I do with Quartet de Moderno.
Make a dollhouse out of them or something.
Well, what I do is that I build the cost of the CD into the ticket price.
Beautiful.
So that people pay $25, they show up, they see the concert, they walk away with a CD.
Amazing.
I think that's a good deal.
I think that's a good deal, too.
But anyway.
That's good. Okay, Richard,
I just want to take a quick second just so people know how to get in touch with me. So, first of all, my website is BOUKAS.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge site. It's got all of my ensembles, all my compositions, scores of my compositions. The stuff that's more guitar-centric, if you go to bukas.com/Brazilian Guitar Panorama, you'll see some of my Brazilian guitar workshop videos.
Mm-hmm.
And then the New York Guitar Seminar that I just did will be under...
That's right.
It'll be under New York Guitar Seminar with hyphens in there, and that's an 8-segment video
that's
coming out. So there's a lot of content there. Any questions your listeners have, they can just get in touch with me at richard@bukas.com. It's real easy, and I love hearing from people, man, because it's like when somebody writes me and says, "Man, I heard this tune of yours," or you know, "I love Garotto, and when I saw you do your workshop and you went deep into his music," it's like, man, it opened up this whole thing. It's like, that's what music's for, man.
Yeah.
It's to elevate our spirit. It's to bring people together. And I don't want to sound all like mushy and
no.
kumbaya, but man, it's like I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, Richard.
And I have every right to be, you know, jaded, bitter, like have a crappy attitude about how.
Do you ever get a crappy attitude? I've got a crappy attitude.
Not as much as I used to, because.
What happened? How did you get rid of that? I want to know how to get. My listeners, a lot of the
okay,
listeners.
Okay, two things.
Most of the emails that I get from listeners are people like me.
They're bitching about their careers?
Regional musicians that are having a hard time justifying being broke at age 40.
Right.
What do you say to them?
Yeah. Well, you went into this, if you went into this and your primary driver was financial, you made a big damn mistake.
Yeah, by the way, people going to college, you made a big mistake if you thought you were going to make a bunch of money.
Well, unless you decide to go into web design or PR or,
sure.
You know, something relate or music production. I mean, you know, but anyway.
There are things that you can do with a creative education.
The way I have mitigated,
right.
you know, what I would call the ambient toxic
right.
Attitude that musicians who feel unfulfilled kind of accrue is, first of all, your life has to be in balance. You can't expect your music to make everything else okay. So, you know, mm-hmm. you have to take care of your body, your mind, and your spirit. You have to have good family and friends.
Family and friends is the way I've said
it. You have to be interested and deeply passionate about other things besides music that inspire you to be a better musician. So for me, it's things like language, ethnic culture, cooking, and then sports, working out. I work out like a maniac, and I mean... Half of the tunes that I start writing and the pieces that I start writing in my head while I'm running or swimming.
Do you when you run and swim? Do you have headphones on?
No, I don't need them because I just put the piece on in my head.
Right. Okay. There
you know, like when I swam around Manhattan in 1990. That's a long swim. It's like 28 miles.
I don't understand how you did that.
Well, you train for it, just like anything else. And I wanted to do it. I had the people to train with, and I did it. But I had my playlist in my head. No, it's not. No, it's not. You build up to it, just like a marathon. It's not a big deal. But anyway, make a long story short, I knew what pieces I wanted to have going on in my head while I was doing that swim. It's the same thing, you know, if I'm on a long run, like a half marathon run or whatever, it's like... You know, but the idea is that when those endorphins start kicking in, the musical ideas just start percolating. And, you know, I got two very quick stories.
But when you run, you do not put headphones on.
No.
Because I do, and I'm wasting a lot of my
time. I run on trails. I want to hear the birds. I want to hear my feet on the leaves in October. You know, I want to hear dogs barking in the distance.
And the smells and all that stuff.
Yeah. I want to be in it. Anyway, two examples of music coming to me while I was competing or training in sports. I was in the middle of a swim workout before, like, the state championships, and my coach was an amazing coach, and he taught me everything I know about swimming, and I started hearing this amazing choro in my head. It was like it was happening, and I knew if I didn't write it down, I'd lose it. And I knew it was going to be dedicated to Hermeto Pascual. Mm-hmm. And so what do? I jump out of the pool. My coach is screaming at me. And I go into the bathroom, and I get this public school industrial strength brown toilet paper. Remember that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Stuff would rip your ass off.
And then I wrote staff lines that were like 6 feet wide.
Yeah.
And I sat on the tile pool deck for 7 hours, and I wrote the goddamn piece.
Right there.
Another time I was on a long bike.
Oh, some middle school toilet paper.
I was on a long bike ride.
Yeah.
And then I had a pen in my little back pouch. I drew staves on my arms and legs, which were conveniently mm-hmm. shaved down,
right.
you know,
for swimming,
for everything, you know, and so
basic aerodynamic activity enhancement
and kinesthetic feel for
there
the water,
you, go.
You know.
There you go.
But anyway, so music can come to you when you're doing other things. You see,
yeah, Beethoven used to take night walks.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, the thing is. It's one thing if you are writing music for, let's say, educational use,
right.
you know, what Hindemith would call Gebrauchsmusik, music for use, you know, then you're not bringing the best of your artistic stuff forward. You're using your craft to generate content.
Right.
There's a difference between that and the music that's deep in your soul that you've got to pull out.
The inspirato.
Yeah. So anyway, so getting back to what you're saying about what we were talking about in terms of artistic negativity and self-disgust and mm-hmm. beating yourself up with your music, beating yourself up with your practicing, with your playing. It's like, man, like, you know, life is bigger, man. Life is bigger than you and your metronome and your footstool, you know, and you got to get beyond that because it's the enrichment of the other parts of your life in balance with music
that'll inform.
Yeah. And so for me, Like, I don't expect my music to make me feel like I'm a whole person, because I take care of the other parts of my being with other people and animals and you know, cultural things and what have you. So you need to have that stuff in balance, because if you're hinging on your music doing it for you, it's like a drug.
Yeah, man.
And it's so uni-focused and so myopic.
And then when you don't get it,
and then when you don't, and you might be playing great, you might be composing great, and it's like, man, it's like, why does that cat get the game? I mean, back when I was playing bebop, I'd sit in with Elvin Jones, you know, at the Vanguard like twice a year, and it would be like this intense love thing. I mean, we'd be looking at each other going, oh my. And that's what I was doing at the time. I was playing quartet. I was the piano player as guitarist with a tenor player, bass player, and drummer.
And he was the tenor player, Elvin Jones?
No.
Elvin Jones
play? Drummer, great drummer.
I don't know these things.
Oh, my God. Anyway, so he played with John Coltrane.
Okay.
Anyway, so at the end of the set, I would say, Elvin, man, we got to do this thing, man. It's like this is like the third time I'm sitting in.
Right.
It's like beautiful, man. He goes, yeah. Never happened. And I would see the guitar players that would be hired by his wife Keiko, and they couldn't play. Not only could they not play, but they couldn't play jazz. Like one guy showed up with a Les Paul. I mean, it was embarrassing. But at the same time, I was seething. And
why is a Les Paul a bad decision for jazz?
Well,
just not the sound.
You can make it. I mean, Pat Martino made solid bodies sound great.
Right.
Put 15 flat ones on.
Look, can we talk? Can I digress for 1 second?
Oh,
because
sure.
I talked to William Kramer Henderson at the Manus guitar seminar.
Yeah.
About that, and we were kind of lost.
About what?
We just started talking about why the jazz guitars, why the hollow body when it creates so much. It seems to create feedback.
Well, you can control that.
But what does it? What does it provide? What is a hollow body? Just for people, we don't know any of this. We could not figure it out between the two of us.
Well, if it's a good instrument.
You look up these things online, it's a bunch of speculation.
Okay,
your opinion about what makes...
Well, you need to have
what makes a Gibson... What is that called? The E something? Whatever.
Well, there's all kinds of models.
But the big...
There's different... Well, if you're talking about a full...
hollow body.
If you're talking about a full arch top...
There you go.
Full-size arch top.
Yeah,
like a classic D'Angelico.
D'Angelico.
Or...
Like the ones at the Met.
Yeah.
Those are acoustic, though.
Well, they have pickups too.
Okay, cool.
But the bottom line is that you need the right combination of instrument, strings, amplifier, in order to get your own sound.
But what is the benefit of hollowing it out? It's just a certain sound.
It's a full.
It's the jazz sound.
It's a full response thing. If you play a Strat on a jazz gig. Now, granted, like you know, Mike. You know, Mike Stern plays telly on a jazz gig and sounds great, and that's his choice. But you know, I played arch tops for a long time, and yes, there are feedback issues, but you can dial that stuff out.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger, fatter, warmer tone than what a flat solid body is going to give you.
Okay, cool. So warmth. It does add warmth.
Yeah, warmth and body and command.
Command.
Yeah, it's a commanding sound.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the difference between good and boom. You know, it's like when you play a note on an arch top and you have just the right combination of strings and amp and the guitar, and you got your settings on the guitar and the amp just right. I mean, there's some gravitas behind that, behind those notes that you're playing.
Yeah.
I mean, all you got to do is like listen to like Kenny Burrell's guitar sound, and you just drop dead. It's just beautiful. Anyway.
But you were saying,
let me ask you a question.
What?
Are there any other questions about my music and stuff that we can talk
about?
Well,
we can't because we're out of time, but it seems like we talked a lot about your music. And again, you know, the main thing to remember is that people are going to be able to look you up very easily these days. And so, you know, one of the questions I do have is you were going to say, you know, the big thing that that we can kind of leave with is you know, when we were talking about people getting depressed about their careers, which you said you've suffered from at certain points.
I mean, you know, it's natural. It's natural.
But one of the big things is to have other things in your life that you can lean on and that you did.
Well,
friends, family, activities, passions.
I would say, you know, it's all about balance, man.
Balance,
you know,
man.
You know, yoga. meditation. You know, these are all things where
meditation.
Again, like if you're counting on your music to make you feel whole, mm-hmm. that's a really dangerous place to be.
Well, you're doing a good job with it. You got the new album out. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
You just need to have things more in balance so that if you have disappointments in your musical life, it's not going to like cave everything in. You know. And also you have to look at the long haul. I've been a band leader, among other things, aside from writing chamber and choral music and guitar music. I've been a small group, you know, jazz or Brazilian jazz leader, composer for 40 years now. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this a long time.
It's a long time.
If I was looking for a certain financial remuneration, if I was looking for a certain kind of level of visibility, number of stars and downbeat or whatever,
right.
it's like I would have given it up a long time ago.
Right.
I'm doing this because that's what I
that's
do.
That's what we do.
It's what we do.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and
right.
if your motivations are something other than creating the art and evolving as a being, then you got to check in with yourself and just really, you know, like take inventory about, you know, why am I doing this now?
Yeah.
And, you know, man, I'm going to be 63 next month, and I feel like I'm just beginning to crack the next ceiling. I'm just beginning to crack the next level as a player, as a composer, as a teacher, you know,
how exciting is that?
Because
most of these people with these jobs and these families, I love jobs and families, but I think that the ceiling gets hit pretty quickly. It seems like the ceiling of like their development as a human being. I don't think they're getting up and going like, I just feel like I'm getting to the next level of what at 63.
Yeah, well,
63 is 2 years from retirement.
Well, that word's not in my vocabulary.
There you go.
I'll be 90 and doing everything
right.
I'm doing right now. But
nice.
but the bottom line is that really when you come down to it, we have the blessing and the curse of creating our own schedule for the most part.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's a blessing because we can flex and take on big projects and really dig in hard.
But it's a curse
and
when
do
things
them.
Are slow.
But it's a curse because if you lack direction or if you're just fumbling around and you feel really vulnerable in a way that's not good.
Yeah.
Man, it's a dark place and
they can affect the people around you too.
You need to take care of the rest of yourself.
Yeah,
so yeah. I mean that's my advice.
That's beautiful information. That's great information. The new CD is Quarteto Moderno live
al vivo.
That's available now on iTunes, I'm assuming?
It won't be until the fall. Because right now
you can go to Rick Boukas. www.boukas, BOUKAS.com. That's BOUKAS.com. /Quarteto. What do you call that thing?
Dash. Moderno. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Moderno.
Yeah,
and they'll be able to find it because it's just going to be all over the web.
And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, has any questions,
Richard.
Whatever, just go to richard@boukas.com.
That's boukas.com, everybody. All right? Richard, thanks so much
for
joining me.
Hey, man. My pleasure.
New New York friend.
Woo!
All right, so that does it with me and Richard. I hope you enjoyed that. This is from his 1994 release, Amazonia, and this is the track Atrás de Nós. That's the way it sounds to me. That's the way I'm going to say it. Atrasdenos. All right, I'll see you guys next time with Jennifer Tobridge.
Agora deixaríamos atrás de nós. Agora vimos tudo antes de nós. Nós sabendo por que não somos contentes, há de nós ver as nossas diferenças. Quanto tempo precisamos antes de desperdício? Não posso falar como tartaruga escondido. Vou dar o teu silêncio. Agora deixaremos atrás. Nós falamos, olhamos, dados, dados.
aprendendo o que deixamos. Enche o coração de um grito sofrimento, dizendo-me que nunca mais acaso há do efeito. Eu preparo a